Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for outdoor people. I was brought up in Merseyside and when I started walking, I was in a land where it felt like we were almost at war with the outdoors. There were signs everywhere, no trespassing, trespassers will be prosecuted, private keep out, no turning here, you can't even turn your car in some people's driveway. And it just felt as though I was confined. And it was only when I went to the Lake District and started walking on the path there, and subsequently to that, I went to Scotland and I realized that actually that's not how things are supposed to be. And now I've lived in Scotland for well over 30 years. And one of the things I celebrate all the time is the access that we have to wild places. I actually think that, you know, being able to have access to the land is a basic human right, really. We all come from the land. And it's ours, and we should all have access to it. So my guest today is John Bainbridge, and he's a campaigner for access rights, and he's also an author in his own right. And I want to talk to him about some of his views about access to the outdoors and some of the issues that he's campaigning about at the moment. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, John, and thanks for the invitation. It's nice to talk to you at last. I've enjoyed your books over the past couple of years, and you've opened my eyes in many fields.
That's great. That's right. Well, you're my favourite kind of guest. You start by mentioning my books. That's really good. That's what I really like. How did your passion for the outdoors start, first of all?
I was born in the Black Country in the Midlands, and we lived, although we lived very close to the industry, we actually lived in the Green Belt. So my first explorations were in the Green Belt, and as a very, very small child, I'd roam fairly freely across that and along the canals. We didn't know what a public footpath was, we just went where we liked. We were out all day, as kids were in the 1950s and the 1960s. So it really started then. And then when we moved to Devon, which I think I was about 13, I started to explore Dartmoor in great detail and would camp there for weeks on end sometimes and really get to know the place. And that, I think, Dartmoor was under great threats at the time. And that's when I also got involved in campaigning for Dartmoor.
Oh, so right at an early age, you were aware of how precious the countryside was, and were involved in campaign. What sort of pressures and threats were on Dartmoor in those days?
Well, they wanted to build a massive reservoir right in the heart of the moor at Swinkham, which would have been a disaster. First of all, it wouldn't have worked because it was too high, too near the source of the river, so it would have dried out every time it was a hot summer. And they wanted to build miles of concrete canals to try and fill it up from other rivers.
Right.
So it would have destroyed the concept of a national park. And then, of course, we had military firing on Dartmoor, which still goes on, and massive threats from the clay mining industry.
Ted, tell me, I've never been to, I don't think I've ever been to Dartmoor. I've maybe crossed part of it on one stage. Tell me about Dartmoor, because if our listeners have not been there, what's Dartmoor like to you?
Dartmoor, certainly when I first knew it, was a very isolated place because very few people actually walked. Thousands do now. Very few people did then. It's the last great wilderness of southern England. In fact, it seems really strange that it's in southern England at all. I mean, I live very near the Pennines now, and you expect that to be wild. And I do a lot of walking in the Lake District of Scotland, and you expect that to be wild. But you don't expect a great mass of wild country right in the middle of southwest England. And it's quite a shock. It's a sort of marmite place. People either love it or they hate it. and for those of us who love it, it's a wonderful place, full of archaeology, some of the richest Bronze Age archaeology in Europe.
Right, I didn't know that. How big is Dartmoor then?
It's about 365 square miles, a little bit bigger than that, actually, I think. And you can literally roam all day on the high moorland and still rarely see a soul. So it's a good place to go for people who are in the south.
Right. Now, I understand that there are pressures on Dartmoor or not. I mean, it sounds to me like a lot of places, like even in Scotland, really, there are places you can go, and actually, it's pretty crowded if you choose the honeypot spots, I guess. But you've only, my experience is, you really only got to walk almost half a mile or a mile from the road, and you don't see anybody. Is Dartmoor like that, or?
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. The other thing about Dartmoor is in 1985, long before there was the Crow Act, Parliament passed the Dartmoor Commons Act, which gave people a legal right to roam, long before Crow. And it also gave people a legal right to wild camp, which makes it the only place really outside Scotland where you can.
So it's quite unique in Britain, sorry, in England, in that case, is it?
It is indeed. Unfortunately, the Dartmoor National Park Authority are now trying to cut back on the areas where people can wild camp. And I'm very involved in a campaign with the Dartmoor Access Group to try and fight that, because although there were problems during the pandemic, we had lots of so-called fly camping. But there were no prosecutions. There are bylaws already to deal with that. And yes, we feel that the new bylaws that the National Park Authority is trying to put through will really punish the innocents, the really responsible wild camper, and that people would break the rules anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've heard stories in the Peak District of gamekeepers going out at night with heat detecting cameras in the middle of the night, trying to find and finding people who are wild camping, doing no harm to anybody, and basically chucking them off the land. Is it that extreme where you are? Or?
It's not that extreme with landowners. The thing is, about 15 landowners own most of Dartmoor.
Right.
Believe it or not, 15, just 15. So they tend not to. And of course, unlike the Peak District, it was never preserved for game shooting. So there wasn't quite the same problem. But what we do have now is a very officious National Park Authority, which is, I think, taking away the very things national parks were created for.
Well, one wonders really what national parks are created for sometimes. What specifically are the national park attempting to do that you think would curb people's abilities to enjoy the environment there?
What they want to do is take away some of the wild camping areas that Parliament granted in the first place.
Right.
They tend to be the wild camping areas that are nearer to the roads. But of course, they're the sorts of places where people who are newcomers or not very confident about wild camping, or perhaps people who are just scared of wild camping and looking to try it for the first time. Those are the sort of places that they will want to camp, so they can perhaps be near to a car, near to people, near to a public transport. And I think it's quite wrong. And the other thing is, although they're consulting on that at the moment until the end of this month, the other thing they want to do is give themselves powers so they can then roll back the wild camping for areas even further without any public consultation at all. And I think that's appalling.
Right. So that's they're wanting a loaded gun in their pocket in some ways. It is.
Yeah. I think it's so contrary to national park purposes. It's so contrary to the spirit of enjoying the outdoors. And as I said before, it's not the people who make a mess or start fires and burn, chop down trees are going to get into trouble, because they will ignore all these rules anyway. The genuine wild camper who's going to get picked on. And I think that's appalling.
I mean, I think that's an important point. We've experienced that to a degree in Scotland as well. I think to a degree that's been in some ways exaggerated. But, you know, we've had, as you say, people who really are. I don't describe them as there's a phrase "dirty camping," which I don't like, but it's really, I think what you said is quite right. It's actually people who are inexperienced. They're new to going to the countryside. They don't know, basically, you know, the kind of things that you or I would know how to behave, you know, basically how to go to the toilet properly and cover it up and keep the place cleaner. And, you know, and there are people who will have a campsite and say, you know, I insist on having a campfire, and will stand up and walk away and leave their tents and stuff. But what you were saying, I think those people are very much the minority. There is a tiny number who probably, you know, create more mess than you would expect. But those people they're new to the countryside, and if you give them an opportunity to learn and to learn how to camp in wild places like that, they will change. How do you think that's right?
I think that's absolutely right. I started camping, and we didn't call it wild camping or anything else. Mm-hmm, it was just camping over 50 years ago, and I shudder to think probably some of the things I did when I was first starting out. I think the situation is one that calls for education. It's the carrot, not the stick, that's needed. I mean, for example, under the proposed new bylaws, you wouldn't be able to tie your tarp to a tree because they're banning that. You wouldn't be able to have a hammock in any form, shape or form because they're banning that. All of these appallingly draconian knee-jerk reactions are what we're seeing to what was a very small problem last year. I think there were 179 recorded incidents in the first year of the pandemic, right, of which the Dartmoor National Park Authority didn't prosecute anyone under the existing bylaws.
So and could have done, which is the important point.
And so if they're not prepared to use their existing bylaws, and they want new bylaws which attack camping per se, I'm a bit concerned that there is a sort of nasty motive to that, that perhaps they want a sort of control freak national park where nothing happens unless they sanction it. And I think we've got to fight that.
I think that's right. I think I can understand, you know, a national park being concerned to protect the fauna and the wildlife in an area. No one's going to argue with that, I don't think. But I think fires are a really good example. There is something I think innate in human beings to want to sit round a campfire. I could understand why people want to do that, and I suppose I'd do it to a degree myself. But my fires tend to be fairly well contained. Yeah. But having said that, if you want to have a campfire, there are actually lots of ways that you can do that in an environmentally friendly way, in a sense. You know, there are the folding mesh fire pits, and there are the ways of having a leave no trace fire that actually probably does very, very minimal damage to the environment. Obviously, things like, you know, one wonders whether the sort of disposable barbecues that are about. I think they're a bit of a menace, those things, and maybe yes, we should avoid those. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
I think it is. Certainly, I mean, we used to use campfires a lot when I started camping. We tended not to later because it was too much trouble. But yeah. I mean, in Scotland, and I walk a great deal in Scotland, right, where is quite a tradition of the campfire. And you think of all those people in the 1920s, the 30s, who went out from Glasgow, and the first thing they did was find somewhere to spend the night and lit a fire.
Yes, yes.
There is that tradition. It doesn't happen so much on Dartmoor, probably maybe shouldn't anymore, I don't know. But when the National Park is talking about the fabric of the moor and how we have to clamp down on wild campers to preserve the fabric of the moor, they conveniently forget that most of Northern Dartmoor is an army firing range where they're firing mortars.
I never thought of that.
It's a special scientific interest. So I think it's all a little bit one-sided.
Well, yeah, and I think also in the use of our land, we have to learn a bit of tolerance as well. And it's a difficult thing. You know, you don't want to see places that you love trashed. But I think what happened over the last year or so, we were dealing with a population that had experienced a pandemic like nothing else we have ever experienced in our generation, or probably in past generations almost, unless you go back to the Black Death. And, you know, that I think changed people's behavior Not always for the best, I guess, but you've got to cut people some slack sometimes, I think, and say, okay, maybe that wasn't the best way, but let's see how we can move forward and make things positive without, my view certainly, is reaching for the big stick of legislation, which seems to be the first recourse for the authorities at times. Is that where you were coming from?
I think so too. We had this massive lockdown. People were basically forbidden from going very far at all. And then the government changed that. They started absolutely positively urging people to get out of the countryside.
Yes, that's right.
We had the National Park Authorities and the National Park Tourist Associations begging people to come into the park. Mm-hmm. And it stands to reason a small number of people, just like people drop litter in the streets, yeah, are not going to abide by the rules.
Yeah.
But to turn that on its head and punish the majority rather than the very, very, very small minority who need educating really anyway is silly.
Yeah. I mean, I came down from a hill walk in Glenafric, which I'm sure you'll know,
in
a fairly remote area in some ways. And when I got back to the road, I started hearing rock music, you know.
Yeah.
And this was shortly after lockdown had been lifted. And I came down and there were, I'd say, about half a dozen, maybe a dozen people. And they were having, you could probably describe it as an audio-assisted picnic. Mm-hmm. But they had big speakers and they had a little generator and they were listening to rock music and having a barbecue. The barbecue looked pretty responsible to me. And, well, yeah, that's maybe not the way I would enjoy the countryside. But to be honest, were they doing any harm? I don't think so. And I think as I drove away, I met two police cars coming the other way. And I'm damn sure what they were going to do is turf these people off. And I thought, well, you know, maybe we need a little bit of tolerance here.
I think we do. It has to be a bit more live and let live. And of course, the other thing is, in Scotland, you've got the absolutely wonderful Land Reform Act.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in England and Wales, we have access to just 8% of the countryside.
That's crazy.
Includes all the footpaths, all the national parks, all the areas of outstanding natural beauty, just 8% of the countryside. And of course, it's the reason why some of us have always been trespassers and things like that, because we don't accept that we shouldn't have access to our countryside. And of course, most of us pay out, if you pay taxes, you're mm-hmm. subsidizing. Sometimes
absolutely.
Massive landowners.
Absolutely.
And I think we should have something back for that.
I think that's right. I'm perhaps even more radical than that. I mean, I think we in Scotland, we have, you know, as you say, a tremendous legislation that gives us right to access, but we have very little control over what happens to that land. And I think, you know, what are a people? But the land they come from and where we put our feet. And no, and you know, the great thing about it is nobody made Dartmoor. They didn't go out and build the bloody place. You know, you're talking about 15 landowners or whatever. It was carved up about 300 or 400 years ago by a load of yobbos, probably.
Yeah, almost certainly true. I think it was the Victorian philosopher John Stuart Mill says that no one has all rights to a land. It's mm-hmm. a common inheritance of the whole species. And I think that's very true. That's always been one of my mottos as I merrily trespass across the country.
Well, that brings me to your books, actually. I noticed you produced, one of your books is called The Complete Trespasser. Yeah. And I think also you talk, you've a number of perhaps more respectable books on hill walking. And I just wondered what's that book about and what do you talk about in that?
Well, I've been involved in outdoor journalism for about half a century, incredible it seems to me. And I'd always trespassed in the countryside responsibly, you know, harmlessly, I think. And I wanted to record some of the things that had happened to me, but also look back at the history of trespassing.
Yeah.
So I did that with The Complete Trespasser. I've also written one or two more where I did just legitimate rambles. And I also write thrillers, which is a sort of byproduct of the whole thing. And even they, I think, tend to have the message
right.
about the land.
Yes.
I've written a couple of thrillers set in the 1930s where the hero is a veteran of the Kinder Scout Mouse Trespass.
Oh, right. A mate of Benny Rothman's. Aye, okay.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing.
But sorry, just to say, you know, I think that's a great way of introducing people to issues rather than making them the fairly dry sort of academic books almost you get about is to bring in thrillers. But one of the things about you know, 1934, I think, was it, am I right, where Benny Rothman's Trespass was took place?
And 1932.
32, that's yeah. Right, sorry. And but if you think, my view is actually that the battle and the struggle for that trespass is very much still going on.
It is. In fact, when I was writing The Trespasser, I did the first edition about 7 or 8 years ago.
Right.
And it really hinged around the Kinder Scoutmouse trespass. But when I was coming to do the second edition, I found out that there had actually been other mass trespasses before. I mean, there's one at Winter Hill in Lancashire when over 10,000 people turned up, I think, in 1896. And there was similarly a mass trespass on Lattery, which is near Keswick in the Lake District, in the 1870s, I think.
Oh, really? I've not heard of these.
So there's a long, long tradition of mass trespassing. And what's quite interesting, if you think of Victorian trespassers, is you get loads of establishment figures out there trespassing, including members of Parliament. So it's fascinating, really.
Well, I suppose in some days, if I can rake up my A-level history, it goes back in some ways to the enclosure movement, because to create a trespasser, there has to be a trespass law, and there has to be someone saying this: you have no right to walk on this land, and until that happened, those people were not trespassers. Does that make sense?
I think that's right. The other thing that concerns me, and another reason why I wrote the book, is the present government wants to pass an act which would affect England and Wales to make trespass a criminal offence rather than a civil offence.
Right.
It hasn't been a criminal offence for 200 years, but of course that's what they want to take us back to. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. The other reason I wrote Complete Trespassing is to try and push the idea that this really needs fighting. It's part of Priti Patel's Police Powers Act.
Right, yes.
Because we could get the situation where you could get, you know, for a fairly harmless trespass or putting up your tent even in the English countryside, you could get 10 years in jail in theory or an unlimited fine. And I think it's a very dangerous road to start going down.
Absolutely. Sort of absolutely.
Turning everything we fought for the last 90 years on its head.
Yes, absolutely, that is. Yes, it is. So that's I didn't realise. I must admit that you've written thrillers as well. You've in some ways gone down the same route that I went in Skydance, my novel. I don't know if you've seen that, but that. Oh right, okay, that was
I very much enjoyed Skydance, and it made me really think about rewilding. I think that's a good case of where you can use fiction to get a message through, because I'd thought about rewilding in a sort of academic way, the way you do.
Uh-huh.
But I think when I read your book, It suddenly occurred to me that this is something I should have been taking far more seriously.
Yeah.
So,
well, particularly as you said, you live in the Peak District,
I live in Cumbria, actually.
Oh, Cumbria. Sorry, I got that wrong.
But I've got the North Pennines just up the road, the Lake District just up the road, and the Yorkshire Dales just up the road. So,
right. I mean, it goes back to. I mean, well, there's an interesting thing in point, really. When I was 19, which wasn't yesterday, I walked the Pennine Way, and the Pennine Way itself had only been in existence, I think, half a dozen years. And it had taken, I think it took an act of Parliament to actually get this long distance path, to get the powers to get it through all these landowners who were basically trying to stop it, because you don't want these oiks walking across your land. And when I walked the Pennine Way, it seemed to me I was in a very wild and unchanged wilderness. I realise now that actually I was walking through very much at times an industrial landscape, and also a landscape that had been profoundly affected by the kind of shooting practices that you were talking about. And so we have seen those changes, and maybe even with Dartmoor, I don't know what Dartmoor's like environmentally. But may, you know, there's a lot that could change on Dartmoor, I would have thought.
I think there is, but I think in order for it to happen, the National Park Authority needs to be making friends, not enemies. And they're doing the latter really well at the moment. Because there are thousands of, by my calculation, there are several thousand people who regularly wild camp on Dartmoor over the years.
Right.
And they're the people that the National Park Authority should be trying to get on its side. And of course, yes. They're the very people that are antagonizing. And I think that's so short-sighted. Because the countryside is under massive threat. Wild places are under threat. We need to have this great debate about rewilding. And for all of this, the national park needs to find friends and allies. So declaring war on wild campers is just silly.
Yeah. And is that what you feel? I mean, how open do you think that the Dartmoor, I don't know what the actual title is, the National Park Authority is to discussions? Are they willing to listen to people, or do you think it's like many things tend to be from this government, it's very much top down?
I think it's very much top down. It's interesting. It wasn't until with these bylaws, it wasn't until they were prodded that they said they would have a consultation. Only they're not inviting people to put in written submissions the way you normally would, perhaps putting adverts in magazines.
Yes.
Things like that, say, please write and tell us what you think. All they've done is organise a Survey Monkey poll, which is singularly pointless because people can make multiple submissions, and I fear some landowners might.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not exactly a democratic process, is
not
it?
Not really, no.
So what for? Obviously, you're quite rightly, I think, campaigning against this, and. How could people get in touch with you or join this campaign or lend their support to what you're doing if they wish to protect access rights on Dartmoor?
Well, they can email me. I've got a sort of open email address.
Okay.
Which I will give you, which is Stravega John. There's a good Scottish word for you. Stravega John.
Indeed it is.
At yahoo.co.uk.
Right, I'll put that on the podcast page.
Yeah, and people can email me there, and I if they're wild campers, I'll pass them on to the relevant groups that are fighting
right.
The wild campers.
Okay. Okay. Oh, well, you may get inundated. Let's hope you do.
I don't care. I'd love to be inundated.
Okay.
We need all the campaigners we can.
Well, absolutely. It's a campaign that needs a lot of support and something that I think we should all get behind, you know? Well, this has been fascinating talking to you. I'll put links to your books on the podcast page, mm-hmm. and indeed links to any campaigns that you've got. And if you want to, if there comes a point where you need particular support or anything like that, do come back and I'll see what I can do through my social media and my podcasts.
Thank you. I've also got a blog called Walk the Old Ways. It's a WordPress blog.
Yes.
Go to WordPress just to do Walk the Old Ways, all one word, effectively.
Yeah.
And what I do, although it started out as a blog about places to walk. I mean, I've recently done the Scottish
Borders.
But it's really about campaigning too, and I put all the latest campaigning news on there.
Oh, well, that's really handy. Okay, so I'll put links to all that. I'll put links to all that on the podcast page. Okay, John, thanks very much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to your next book.
yeah, well, I'm working on that right now. Okay, brilliant. You take care. Thanks,
Amy. And you. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye. Well, a big thanks to John Bainbridge there for coming on Outside In. I'll put all the links to his blog and to his email address and the campaigns that he's leading, and also to some of his books on the podcast page. Just to tell you a little bit about what's coming up on Outside In, I've got Paul Pritchard, who resides now in Tasmania, coming on to talk about his book, The Mountain Path. Quite a profound book, this, and a man who has survived very severe life-changing injuries, to talk about how he's adapted and his philosophy in life. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Paul. That probably about a week or so from now, I'm thinking, but I'll put a wee tweet on Twitter when it's coming up. I do hope you've enjoyed listening to this show, and if you have, thanks very much for joining me, and do come again. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.